Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Friend, and welcome to Catch Up with Louise McSharry. This is the podcast where I do my best to keep you up to date on everything from news to entertainment. And then on Fridays, we always have a chat with someone who is interesting or has an interesting story to tell or has something interesting going on. And I can't wait to tell you about today's guest. But before we get into that, little reminder, I have a live show in the Laughter Lounge. Thank you to everybody who's bought tickets so far. It's coming up on May 9th and it's going to be really good fun. I'm really looking forward to it. So if you fancy a night out, please do head to the old show notes. There's a link there where you can get tickets. We're going to have a ball. And then also, I just wanted to flag that I got a good few messages from people who enjoyed my ADHD hyper-focus rant about Beyonce in the entertainment episode on Wednesday, which felt appropriate. And I had mentioned on my Instagram stories that I was hoping to do a kind of bonus outside of the regular Patreon episodes that I normally do, another one about Beyonce and the new Coach Carter album. Coach Carter? That is not what it's called. Cowboy Carter. Coach Carter is a film. Sorry. The new Cowboy Carter album. And I still am hoping to do that. When I said that, I had forgotten that that it was bank holiday this week. So whenever I have 4 days to do my work instead of five, I'm always just flat to the mat. So I didn't have time to do it this week, but I'm still hoping I'll get to do it next week. And there's loads of stuff over on the Patreon. If you fancy supporting the podcast, you feel like it's something that maybe you'd buy me a coffee for, you might check that out. patreon.com/catchupwithlouisemcsharry. In terms of recommendations and news, I don't really have a lot. It's been a pretty quiet week. I haven't been doing a whole lot. I've just been working and mothering, which is enough. And I have been watching more of Big Mood, which I mentioned the other day. That's the new Nicola Coughlan show that's on Channel 4. It's all available on channel4.com at the moment, or if you have, you know, the Channel 4 streaming service on your TV or weekly on Channel 4. I think I mentioned the other day that I just started watching it. I've watched a lot more of it now and I can wholeheartedly recommend it. It's great. It's got lots of laughs, but it's also got a bit of meat in it. Really deals with mental illness head on, which I think is great. Always good to have different lives represented on TV. And it's smart and funny and everything you kind of want from a 24-minute Channel 4 program. So yeah, can wholeheartedly recommend that now. However, I really would like to just get stuck in to today's episode because obviously, as I say to my guest at the start of our chat, this is not a sporting podcast. But when I met Hannah Tyrrell, I just immediately was like, I have to get her on the podcast. I found her so impressive. We were both on a panel together for an International Women's Day event. And I really didn't know a huge amount about her ahead of researching her because I was leading the panel. And her athletic achievements are incredible. Like, she has won the All-Ireland for women's senior football. She has won the Six Nations with the Irish women's rugby team. She is someone who just has excelled at athletics in such an incredible way. And we do talk a bit about her sporting career, but mainly kind of the impact that it has had on her as a person and how it shaped her becoming a person and kind of the role that sport can play in young people's lives. But also, she's someone who speaks really openly and honestly about her experience with mental illness and the challenges that she faced and, the large portion of her teens when she was excelling at sport, but really fighting a big battle in her mind. She's also just really articulate and really smart about like equality. And yeah, I just think she's super impressive. And I know that you guys are going to love her. So even if you're not a sport person, my friends, I am begging you to stay with this episode, because it's not about sport per se. It's just about being a human being in the world and the pressures we put on ourselves and how we develop as people. I feel like I said about 20 times there, so I apologize. I try not to script these things because I want them to feel realistic and natural. So hopefully you can have a bit of patience for me with that. Anyway, without further ado, let's get into this. Let's get into this chat with Hannah Tyrrell. Well, Hannah, first of all, thank you so much for having me in your beautiful home. This space is gorgeous. And thank you. Met your lovely dog and your daughter. And it seems like things are really lovely here. Such a nice vibe.
Yeah, look, we love living in the area. We were obviously very lucky to get this wonderful house. And mm-hmm. yeah, I'm just really enjoying it. So yeah, long may it continue.
Absolutely. So your daughter is 9 months old.
Yeah, Aoife's 9 months old. Yeah.
How have you found the descent into parenting?
Yeah, look, it's had its ups and downs, I suppose, but we've been very lucky. Aoife is very placid and happy and social, so she's always been a good sleeper for us. She's always been a really good eater. She's a very sturdy girl, always been very healthy, so we've been lucky in that regard. And you know, we both have a great support network, so we've had so many friends and family kind of looking out for us and helping us and chipping in with babysitting and stuff like that. But I don't know. I don't think anything can really prepare you for what parenthood brings and motherhood brings. And as someone who always had a very busy lifestyle, to have someone come into your life who takes up an awful lot of time, yeah, but also is someone you want to be around and obviously protect and mind, it changes your whole perspective, yeah, I suppose, and they become the priority, really.
Yeah, it is hard, though. I found it really, really hard. Really hard. I still find it hard to kind of find the right balance where I feel like I'm, because I like to do loads of things, where I feel like I'm fulfilled, but I'm also doing what I need to do to feel fulfilled as a parent. Like, I think that balance is really hard to strike for some people if you're busy.
Yeah, absolutely. And for me, particularly, obviously, my sporting career is a lot of trainings in the evening and trying to balance that, making sure I'm here for Aoife and obviously for my wife, Circa, like to help in all of that, but also doing something that I love to do. And I feel like there's more to give in sport. It was difficult for me to kind of decide whether I continue to stick with that this year, or do I leave that behind and give everything I can to Aoife and watch her grow up, because you don't want to miss anything either, no, you know, when you're gone so much. So yeah, that was difficult, but we're making it work. We're balancing it, and I think we're getting the best of both worlds right now, which is great.
So this isn't a sport podcast, as you know, and I am not a sport expert, although I have to say I'm really enjoying sport these days. Something's changed within me. I'm more into it than I used to be. But there will be a lot of people listening who aren't familiar with you and aren't familiar with sport. They'll know the basics. So let's go back to the very beginning. Where did your career in sport begin?
Started when I was really young. I come from a family of, there's five of us and I'm in the middle. My two older sisters were never really big into sport, but I had a couple of best friends who were boys, and they were joining the local soccer team around six or so, literally around the corner from our house. And, you know, they were doing it, so I was doing it, kind of thing. And started about seven, played with them all the way up till I was about 12 or 13. I was the only girl on the team, and I had to leave that team just because it was kind of getting dangerous for girls to play with the boys, and I needed to find my own team and league.
How did you feel about that at the time?
At the time, it was tough. I probably didn't understand the implications of that, because looking back now, like, I was the only girl, I was the only one who had to go and find a new team. Everyone else got to continue, yeah, and I felt a bit left out. Like, I understand from their perspective and the league's rules and stuff like that, but there was no girls team in the area for me to join, and so I actually had to give up that sport. Luckily for me, I fell into Gaelic football through secondary school, and then joined my then local club, Round Towers in Clondalkin, and like my Dublin career kind of kicked off from there. But I'm very glad the way things did happen, but you know, maybe my career might have been very different had I not had to leave that team, because I don't think I would have maybe played Gaelic football.
Yeah, that's interesting, isn't it? Mm. And maybe you would have been at the World Cup last year.
No, I don't know if I was ever that good, to be honest. I wouldn't put myself in that bracket. I was decent, but not at their level, no way.
Yeah. Well, sure, you don't know, though, do you? Because you didn't have the time.
I think, look, there's the Katie McCabe's and Denise O'Sullivan's of the Irish team. I'm nowhere near them, so and I'm happy with that.
Well, no, because instead you got to be the Hannah Tyrrell of your own teams. So you started playing Gaelic football, and as you say, your Dublin career started there. So when did you first play for Dublin?
I first played for Dublin when I was about 13, underage, long time ago.
Okay, so that's quick. So yeah. You finished soccer. We're going to call it soccer for the purposes of this conversation.
Yeah, I call it soccer, so it's okay.
We finished soccer at 12, and then by 13, you're on a Dublin team.
Yeah, I kind of
that's
fell into
impressive.
It. Yeah, it just happened that way, I suppose. When I joined, there were trials for Dublin pretty soon after, and I was put forward and picked from there, and that set off a Dublin career for me that kind of went on for the next 10 years. And I was very lucky to play with some incredible players and teammates and on some really, really successful teams. And I never, when I joined, I didn't understand the importance of GAA and your community in the parish and how privileged I was to get to wear Dublin jersey. Because I hadn't come from kind of that background and what that was like.
And also you were a kid.
Yeah, exactly. But there was a lot of girls there who'd been trying to get onto that team for a long time. And I kind of strolled
in.
Was like, hey, what's going on here?
What's the big deal?
Yeah, exactly. You know, like I obviously understand it now and that grew as time went on. But yeah, look, I've been very lucky in my career, my Dublin career in particular, with some of the teams I've been on.
What role outside of the actual sport did being in a team playing GAA at a high level or playing GAA at all have on you as in terms of your personal development?
I think for me, I always had very good social skills. I always made lots of friends. I had probably lots of different groups of friends. But for me, it was those friendships really that brought me through, particularly in my teenage years. I struggled with my mental health an awful lot, and it was kind of the relationships and the friendships I've made through that really helped me to overcome all of those. But sport for me in particular, I always had a drive and ambition to succeed at anything I did, regardless of whether it was sport or something else. But it gave me an awful lot of discipline, particularly from a team aspect. I think people always ask, would I ever do any individual sports? And I just don't think I have the discipline or the determination to stay at an individual sport, because if it's raining outside, I'm kind of like, I don't really want to go training today. Whereas with a team sport, you very much feel obligated and like it's your duty and everyone else is doing it, so you need to commit. So that was kind of a big thing for me. And I suppose that drive has transferred a lot across into like I'm a teacher and like in school and stuff like that. I try and have discipline for the kids, but also be a little bit flexible in terms of, you know, everybody has different backgrounds and all the rest. So trying to show them that discipline and structure in particular, structure is the big one, can be quite good in your life, but that obviously having flexibility for certain things can be massive. I probably didn't apply a lot of that to myself in terms of my own mental health, you know, when I was going through it. But sport has just been massive for me. The biggest thing is the relationships and the friendships that I've made that I still have to this day.
Yeah, I see that over and over again, even within my own friendship circles. I know a group of girls who are still, you know, they're well into their 30s and they're still, well, are they well into their 30s? I think they are. No offense, hags, that's what they call themselves, if I have just aged you up. But they all know each other from playing, I think it's football, it might be Camogie, I'm not sure, but anyway, GAA. And they are such an amazing group of women. They are so tight-knit. They care about each other so deeply, but they're all so different. But they have this intense friendship that makes me really jealous, to be honest. Like, I think it would have been a really good thing for me to be on a sports team. I played soccer until I was like 16, but I hated it, and I didn't get on with the girls on my team, so that's a bad example. But like I can see that it is a beautiful bond that you have.
Yeah, like for me, I joined Round Towers Clondalk and they were my local team, and they're no longer my club anymore. My new club is Nafina, and it's actually quite rare in Gaelic football to transfer clubs, but unfortunately when I left for a little rugby hiatus and came back, Round Towers unfortunately didn't have a senior team, and this was now the local club that I joined for my Dublin ambitions. But the girls in Round Towers, even though I'm no longer officially a teammate and all the rest, I still meet up with them all the time. We're still in WhatsApps. We still hang out on Christmas and all the rest. And you know, have play dates with the kids. And I think it's so important. They've been there for me through some of my really, really low days. And they've been there through all the highs. And I think it's just brilliant. And, you know, we will be friends until well into, you know, my 60s, their 70s, because some of them are a bit older.
Get the dig in.
Now, you know, we'll be friends for life, and it's just the way it is, and we're all there for each other regardless.
Yeah.
And it's brilliant. Like, it transcends sport, and I think that's what's so important. We have so many good memories to look back on, but the friendships and the bonds that you make are the best things to come out of sport.
Yeah. So I'd like to come back to maybe some of the low days, but I think we should continue with sport for now. So you mentioned there that you went on a little rugby jaunt. So tell us about that.
Yeah, never planned. So I played Dublin right throughout my teenage years, and when I got a little bit older. When I initially joined Dublin, I was goalkeeper. Didn't particularly like it, but it was the job that needed doing, and so I did it regardless. But when I got a bit older, I started to be a bit more stubborn and wanted to play outfield, and so I was pushing for that a little bit. And while I was trying to be an outfielder, I met a player, Sharon Lynch, who played rugby for Old Belvedere and was kind of in the midst of trying to get into the national squad. And she'd always said to me, I think you'd be really good at rugby. I think you should give it a go. And I never grew up, we weren't a rugby family. We would have watched the odd games, but, you know, I didn't even know there was a rugby club in Clondalkin. Sorry, guys. and... Yeah, she just kind of convinced me to come down to a training session and give it a go. And yeah, I went down one night to Old Belvedere and fell in love with it, and played with their second team, had a bit of fun, but it was never going to be my main sport, because Dublin and Gaelic football was where I wanted to be. And I went back to Dublin, and then a couple of months later, I got a call out of the blue from a guy called Stan McDowell to ask would I like to come into the Irish Sevens team for a trial and a setup for Rugby Sevens, which was being brought into the Olympics for the first time in Rio in 2016. And I kind of said, look, I've nothing to lose, I might as well give it a go. And from there, I was offered a contract, and my rugby journey started. And I played with the Sevens and 15s for 7 years or so, you know, playing in two World Cups, winning a Six Nations, just travelling the
casual
world.
Casual stuff like that. Yeah.
No, again, look, very lucky. Just the teams I fell into was incredible. And the opportunities I got through the best coaches and nutritionists and facilities and all the rest was phenomenal. And I never expected to be out so long from GAA. I really thought it would be 1 or 2 years, and after the Olympics, you know, come back to Dublin. But they just kept offering me a contract, and I was really enjoying it and pretty decent at it. So I kept going. And
so I've got two questions off the back of that. Number one is, how do you have that conversation with Dublin where you say, I'm going to go and do this other thing?
Yeah, that was really hard. Yeah. This was in 2014, and I had gone back to Dublin with all intentions of fighting for an outfield spot. And the coach at the time was like, no, we want you as a goalkeeper. The most recent goalkeeper had retired, and we think we have a really good shot. And I, again, was disappointed, but understood, again, this was the role that they wanted me. And
you play for a team. And,
exactly, all that sort of stuff. So I did it. And we played the league, and we were doing quite well. And we actually reached the league final for the first time ever. But a couple of weeks before, I'd been approached by Ireland and offered all this, and I'd been kind of doing little trials in the background. It was really difficult. It was probably slightly easier to step away from Dublin because I was in goal, and it wasn't...
Yeah.
Like, I wanted to play for Dublin, but I wanted to be an outfielder. So it was easier in that way, but it was still incredibly hard. Like, telling the players, like, we were on a high, we just reached a league final for the first time. We had a lot of young players coming through. We'd been doing really well, and their starting goalkeeper, which can be quite difficult to find, a very, like, I'm not trying to big myself up at all, but when you get a solid goalkeeper, they tend to last there for a very long time because they can be quite hard to find. And when I told them I was stepping away, everybody was quite shocked. They didn't obviously see it coming. I hadn't really told people that I was in training with the Irish team, but I tried to explain that this was an opportunity that women and girls in Ireland don't get very often. There wasn't the professionalism we have now. There wasn't any, like, League of Ireland wasn't at the stage it's at now, where the girls are getting played, and most people, if they wanted to, be professional or semi-professional had to go abroad.
And that was actually the question that I was gonna, my other question was, so what did a contract mean? Like, was that professional? Was that semi-professional?
It was, yeah. So contract was semi-professional, and that we would be training like 4 times a week kind of thing, but it'd be Monday to Friday. Like, that would be my job. Now, I was a student at the time as well, so it kind of worked out that way, but basically I was being paid to play the best coaches, the best facilities, you know, traveling the world, representing my country, potentially going to the Olympics. Yeah. And I was like, this is something I can't turn down. I've never really given myself an opportunity to be the best athlete I could be because of the eating disorder I'd had. And, you know, as I said, I was young, I was 23, and why not for a year or two and I could always come back to Dublin. That was my big thing. Like, for a year or two,
I mean, that's
not
so hard to fight with, because even earlier when you were saying, you know, trying to balance playing sport, and you play sport at the top level, like for the sport that you play, but having to try and balance that with your job and being a mother, you know, if you could train during the day for your sport, that would make your life so much easier.
Absolutely. Yeah. That was the big thing. Like, it just getting to be an athlete all the time, and then come home in the evening and your job is done, and just to be able to recover and all the rest and be the best that you can be. And as I said, the added bonus of getting to represent Ireland, you know, traveling the world,
the Olympics.
Yeah, we didn't reach the Olympics, unfortunately, but
the prospect,
it was incredible. And even like the girls I met on other teams, we're still friends now and in contact and stuff like that, which is brilliant. But it was really difficult because my contract said that I obviously couldn't play any other sports because of injury. So I had to step away from Dublin, and it was really difficult. And I think a lot of girls were quite hurt and upset just because we had a huge chance and I was taking away a part of that chance.
So then how did you go back?
I was probably lucky that I left in 2014. I didn't come back till 2021. Okay. So
they had time.
In 2020, when COVID hit, all rugby activities were stopped. We were again in the middle of trying to go to the Tokyo Olympics. That was postponed. There was meant to be a World Cup in New Zealand for 15s in 2021, and that was postponed by a year. And for me, when I moved to just 15s, that's completely amateur. So I had a job, and then I was training twice a week with the 15s midweek. Mm-hmm. And then at the weekend, you would spend all weekend in a hotel and training with the girls. So Friday evening to Sunday afternoon, you were gone from your family every weekend in the build up to the Six Nations, which is like, could be 12 to 15 weeks overall. Yeah. And so when that was pushed back, I found it very difficult to continue or want to continue to give 100% to that and the commitment there, because we had plans to get married at that point. You know, we knew we wanted to start a family. I was paying for a mortgage, and the thing about 15s is because it's amateur, you're obviously not getting paid at all, and then there are times when you have to take a lot of time off work. And as a secondary school teacher, that was very difficult for me, and I didn't have permanency in my job or anything like that. And so I had decided I was going to retire after the World Cup anyway, if we made it there. And then when it was pushed out by a year, I just kind of went, I can't mentally and physically do this for another year. It's not fair on me, and it's not fair, particularly on my family and circuit. Yeah. And so I decided to retire. But with COVID, when rugby was stopped leading into kind of 2021, I went back and played GAA for the first time in a few years because that wasn't stopped. And so I played a bit with my new club, Nafina, got noticed by the Dublin manager, Mick Bowen, and he was kind of encouraging me to come back. And I said, look, I'm not coming back now. I want to go play in this World Cup. And then when the World Cup got postponed, I went, hold on, any chance you still have me? And so, yeah, he was delighted to have me on board. He wasn't around. He wasn't the manager when I left in 2014. Yeah. So
kind of a fresh start.
It was. And a lot of the girls there, I knew some of them, but there was a lot of new faces and young faces. And it was very difficult for me to come in because I came in 2021 and they were on the back of, they'd won 4 All-Irelands in a row and were going for 5 in a row. And I came in trying to first just get in the squad, you know, and then try get a jersey. And luckily enough, we had a brilliant year right up to the final, and I got loads of minutes, and unfortunately lost to Meath, but I got to play outfield, which is what I wanted. So yeah. Very happy. And yeah, it's been a dream. And obviously last year, thankfully, we managed to win the All-Ireland. And that was the one thing I had, was to win a senior All-Ireland.
Yeah. So, wow. What a career. It is. I know you're super humble, so you're not going to say this, but like, it is incredible. Like, to play at that level in more than one sport is not something that very many people get to do. I mean, I remember when Michael Jordan tried to play baseball, it did not go that well.
I'm definitely no Michael Jordan, I tell you that.
You know what I mean? Like, you don't get to, not many people get to play at top level, you know, in more than one sport. It's really incredible. Like, I feel like athleticism, or like, it's in you. Like, I feel like you were probably born with that. Do you feel that way?
I am very lucky and privileged to have played in the teams and had the opportunity that I had. And again, to win what I have won, I am immensely proud of that. And I know, looking back, I'll appreciate it so much more when I'm finished playing. And yeah. I've always been sporty, outgoing, half decent at most sports that I played. I'm terrible at badminton, unfortunately, which drives me mad, but here we are.
You can't have it all, Hannah. Yeah. Like, that's just not how it works.
Yeah, no, look, sports is just my thing. Yeah. And I love doing it. It just brings so much positivity into my life. And the release of endorphins that I get just makes me so happy that I don't want it to end, to be honest.
I'm jealous of that. I would love to love sport, but it just has not gone that way for me. I'm still like, I'll find my thing eventually, maybe, who knows.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like, a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
But let's go back, because you've mentioned a couple of things through the conversation. You mentioned obviously that you had some really difficult years in your teenage years, and you mentioned an eating disorder. So tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah. So probably roughly started when I was about 12 or 13 or so. Obviously a very difficult time for young teenagers. And
so right around that time then, when you were stopping playing soccer and starting to play football.
Yeah. Like, again, I've no idea if it kind of impacted or not. It probably did slightly. I just was in a very vulnerable position. I had a great family, great support network, and all the rest, but I had always been, as I said, very ambitious and high achieving, and I didn't just apply that to sport in school with my friends, and I had a lot of doubts about myself and very low self-worth, and I just felt like I wasn't a good enough human, really, in every aspect. And I wanted to be a better friend, a better sister, you know, a better daughter. I want to be better in school. I thought, you know, I was playing Gaelic football where I didn't really want to be in a position as a goalkeeper. And so I thought maybe if I was skinnier, you know, I might be an outfielder. All these kind of things I thought would change my life instantly and easily. And so I just decided to go on a very simple diet that ended up developing into an eating disorder in the form of bulimia. And I kept it very secret. I didn't really know what I was doing initially, but, you know, as time went on, I developed all these negative coping methods of you know, avoiding food, counting calories, making myself sick, binging, purging, all that sort of stuff, and hiding it from everybody, you know, lying to people about what I was eating and all the rest. And I was very good at hiding it. And I, with bulimia, you don't really see much change in the scales, to be honest. So again, I felt like I was constantly failing at that and not doing well. And I got stuck in a repetitive cycle of, you know, failing basically. And I hated myself for it and I was very ashamed. And there was an urge and a desire for me to punish myself for that. And for me, that came in the form of self-harm. And the self-harm for me, as I said, it was that punishment. It was that kind of almost to try and get a fresh start. So I would binge and purge, feel that shame, feel this overwhelming urge and desire to self-harm until, like, and it doesn't go away. It's so hard to, like, describe it, but it's just this gnawing. It's almost, and I don't want to compare it to, it's almost like an addiction where it does not leave you and it's all you can think about until you do it. And when I did self-harm, I would get this kind of relief, instant relief. And for me, it was like I was letting the negativity and the toxins out of my body and I was punishing myself and I could start afresh again tomorrow and try lose weight again. But unfortunately, that relief, that high doesn't last very long. And I knew I shouldn't be self-harming, but it was the coping method that
it was working for you.
Exactly. And I would then feel shame and embarrassment for what I was doing, and I was hiding it from everybody, and I just got stuck in a cycle of, you know, waking up, restricting, and then binging, purging, self-harming, hiding from everybody, you know. And I was very bubbly and outgoing and social, and I put on a mask to hide that from everybody. And, you know, time went on and my self-harm was well hidden. I still went out and played sport, even on days when I really didn't want to. And they were my saviors, because it was an hour or two of the day where I could forget about the negative thoughts telling me that I was horrible and that, you know, nobody liked me and I was worthless and a burden and fat and all the rest. And then I would just do that day all over again. And it got worse and worse, obviously, as time went on. My self-harm, I needed more and more of it to get that same kind of feeling of relief. And my eating disorder got worse. Again, appearance-wise, most people probably didn't notice again, because my weight fluctuated, but not really to the extreme so much. But I was damaging my body terribly. Just got to a point when I was kind of in my later teenage years, and I was in sixth year, and the pressure and everything, I felt like a burden, felt like too much, and I tried to take my own life.
That's a long time. Sorry, I know you've just said something really big and we'll come back to that, but that's a long time. So 13 to 6 to 18.
So, like, just it built, it started off, you know, quite minor very early on, and then it just developed into me needing more and more, and this taking over more and more of my life. And as I said, I still went to trainings and sport and all the rest, and hid a lot of these things. And, like, again, deception, lying, I became very good at it. But
you must have been exhausted. And
that was the culmination of me trying to take my own life, was just I was physically and mentally and psychologically exhausted. And I felt like I could not do this anymore. And a big reason why I didn't speak out was I felt like I was a burden, you know. And again, there's so much awareness around mental health and eating disorders and all that now. But back then I didn't know much about it. There was no real awareness that I knew of. There was no mental health week in school and people coming in to talk about things. And so I felt like I was the only person who had this and who suffered from this. And for me, you know, I was very fearful if I reached out and asked for help that there was nobody that could help me. And this was, you know, that
final, it didn't feel like an option, obviously.
Exactly. And for me, like, I was nearly fearful of finding out that answer, because I knew then for definite this was my life forever. And I think that just culminated for me in it would just be easier if I wasn't here. Easier on my family, easier on myself. And there would just be that calmness, I suppose. And yeah, it was a long few years. Don't get me wrong, I had so many good days during that and all that. But
still in the back of your mind,
exactly,
it's always there.
It's always there. Yeah. It's, you know, it just was part of who I was. And it was the crutch that I used to get me through everyday life.
So that's a long time, as I've said. You must have had to relearn how to live.
Yeah, like it takes over a huge part of your life. And so, like, even then, when I tried taking my own life and my family found out, I was brought to PA to house, and then I ended up actually entering into a facility, inpatient facility, to try and deal with things. And even when I came out of there, the biggest thing and the biggest difference was everybody knew now. My friends, my family, my teammates. I was in there for 6 months, you know, when I was only 18. And my,
it's a long time, six months.
It's a very long time. It wasn't meant to be that long, but it was what I needed. And I wasn't fixed when I came out. I still had an eating disorder. I just had, I suppose, better tools to cope with.
To manage it,
I probably wasn't quite ready to recover and take that step myself. But the biggest thing was the confidence and the hope I got from the amount of people that actually supported me, because I didn't think I'd have that. And I don't know why I didn't think that. Nobody had ever shown me otherwise. But I just had that in my head. And that's what, I suppose, mental illness do. It isolates you from everybody and tries to tell you all the bad things about yourself. And so, it took a few years. I would say I wasn't fully recovered till I was about 24, I'd say. 23, 24, around the time I started to play rugby, I was kind of in the recovery stage or the tail end of it. But it was a lot of kind of, you know, two steps forward, one step back. And I leant on my friends, in particular my wife Circa, who I'd met through Gaelic football a couple of years prior. You know, she didn't know me prior to the hospitalization or anything like that, and was just there for me and trying to help in every way that she could, amongst so many other friends and you know, even old teachers and people I hadn't seen in years were reaching out to try and help me. And it was such a boost for me to know that people did care. And so it kind of gave me that hope to really try. And I threw myself into recovery. And as I said, it wasn't straightforward. It wasn't perfect. But I eventually got there and I eventually learned to love myself. And that the biggest thing I had to, I suppose, learn was that I'm not perfect. I never will be. And that I will fail. That was the big thing. I never wanted to fail or not succeed. I always set goals that were unattainable and they were never realistic. So I was always failing and I had to change that. So, I became a very much a glass half full. I know that's cliche, but I just had to look at things in a more positive and realistic way. And clearly Siba agrees with that.
A vote of confidence from the front room. I want to talk about why you've decided, you've made the decision, or you, I know I'm not the first person you've spoken to about this, but why you made the decision to talk about it. But before we get there, I think the concept of being a burden is something that's worth touching on more, because I think that it's something that so many people struggle with. And I think in particular young people, because until you have had the opportunity, and I would say the honor, to support someone that you love through something difficult, it's easy to feel like needing help is being a burden. And it's only when you get older and you have a friend who's going through a rough time and you realize how fortunate you feel to be able to be there for them, that you realize it's not actually a burden at all. Like, you work with kids all the time. Is that something that you feel like we need to communicate more to them?
Yeah, I think so. For me, growing up in a very busy household, you know, there was always so much going on. I think I felt like they don't need this right now. You know, they've other things to be doing. I'm very lucky. I have a roof over my head. You know, we never wanted for anything. And I, you know, my siblings, while we fought and all the rest, were always there for me. And I don't know why I felt like that. It just felt like I wasn't worth anything, really. And, you know, I shouldn't be putting this on my parents. And yeah, I'm very conscious and aware of that right now. And yeah, particularly for young kids, society nowadays has changed so much from when I was younger, and it's continuously developing, and particularly social media has such an impact on their lives. I'm very aware of what it's like for them to grow up in these difficult times. And again, parents are busier than ever. I was very lucky that, you know, while my dad worked, my mom was a stay-at-home mom, so she was always there. But I know that a lot of kids don't have that, and therefore probably feel like they're even more of a burden now, because everyone's lives are so busy. But a big part for me as a teacher is not only obviously trying to get them to fulfill their academic potential, but it's just to mold them into, you know, human beings who can contribute to their community, but also just reach their potential in any aspect of their life. Academics are not for everybody. We understand that. And it's about making sure that school for them is a safe haven that they can come to and enjoy and get something out of it, regardless of whether that's from the books or not, kind of thing. And so
does all that play into your choice then to talk about these things?
Yeah, kind of. I I never planned on talking out about it. When I was getting my first cap with rugby, we won the Six Nations that year in the 15s, and there was a book being written, and because I was a rookie, a newbie that year, I got a chapter in it. Mm. And she was kind of just, the author was kind of just trying to get like some info and background, like tell me about your upbringing. And then she was kind of, I didn't say anything about the hospital or anything else or my background too much, but she was kind of like, oh, you have a bit of a gap here, like what are we doing here? And off record, I talked about, look, I was in a hospital here, I struggled with my mental health. And she asked, would I be okay if she put that in? And I said, you know what, why not? Like, I'm not ashamed anymore. Yeah. It's over it at that stage.
Nor should she be. Yeah,
exactly. And it published there, and then I just had so many people reaching out to say fair play, like for speaking out. This was back in 2015, and like a couple of girls saying thank you so much, I thought I was the only one who felt this way, and I'm now going to talk to people. And that very much is the goal for me now, is I share my story because I know that there are people out there that struggle, and that maybe struggle to come forward and speak to people because they feel so alone or that nobody understands. And if my story can help one person, then that is more than enough for me to share it. And so I'm very happy to do that. And, you know, I understand I'm in the spotlight a little bit and I am a role model. So not only on the pitch, but off the pitch, I can have an impact. And I'm very lucky to be able to do that.
Yeah, I think it's incredible that you do it. Like, I bang on about it all the time in this podcast. I just think it's so valuable when we talk about our difficulties because they're so, like, very rarely unique. Like, usually someone else has been through it or something similar, or is going through it.
There's 7 billion out there, so I'm almost certain someone's gone through it.
Yeah, and that feeling of, oh, that's how I feel, or like recognition, is so powerful and can be so healing. So I think it's great that you do.
I think it's quite therapeutic for me as well. As I said, I never planned to speak out about it, and now I give talks, you know, all around the country when I can, outside of my job, to schools, to organizations, to charities and all the rest. And I very much go off script and kind of just tell my own story. Yeah. And so I never noticed, but my wife, after sitting in a couple of those, said to me, like, I love coming to these talks. And I'm a bit like, all right, I'm just bearing my soul here, but okay. And she's like, no, because I learn something new about you every time, or I learn a new tidbit or story, because she wasn't there for most of it when I went through it. And for me, I never really thought about that. You know, but I suppose I have so many memories of it that, you know, what I talk about just comes out, and I find it very therapeutic.
Yeah.
Again, I suppose it's a way I've, you know, helped myself to
process,
overcome it, and
kind
of just made it a normal thing for me to talk about, because it was very much stigmatized, and it's the reason why things got so bad for me, because I didn't speak out.
Yeah. Well, I think it's great that you do, as I've said. And we actually met at, it wasn't a talk per se, but we were doing a panel for International Women's Day together. And I was so impressed with you because you've got a fire in you when we were talking about like gender equality and stuff. I was so impressed because I didn't know you really at all. You obviously have strong feelings about kind of gender equality.
Yeah, I suppose when you grow up, you know, in a society that is male dominated and that has always been privileged towards particularly white males, and you play a sport that is never seen as equal just because of the gender, that can be quite difficult. And I suppose I met that early on with soccer when I was the only girl on my team, and people used to see me as a weak link, and I kind of, that's where the fire in the belly started. So I'm like, I'm gonna show you, just because I'm a girl doesn't mean, you know, that I'm useless. And it just kicked off for me for there. I just don't understand why people can't see males and females for equal as they are. Yes, the males will always be stronger genetically and all the rest, but if given the same opportunities, women can do exactly what men can and more. And I think back, you know, as a historian, we cover like women in 20th century Ireland and the struggles that they had, like the marriage bar, making women give up their jobs when they got married, and pay equality and not being able to get the education. And like, I just think of all the poor women that we have missed out on, that never got to reach their potential, who potentially had the cure for many diseases or would have come up with some amazing inventions that we never ever got to see.
I always think about that with my granny. Like, my granny is amazing. Like, she my whole life she never had a career per se, because she was raising the children and all the rest.
That's a career in itself.
But she, oh, well, yes, absolutely. But, you know, not a kind of career as we would think of it. But she always had a gig going. Always, like, and she was doing flowers for people's weddings, and then she was teaching flowers, you know, how to do flowers, and then she was had a network of classes around the city. And she, the way she would speak about the way she managed the business interactions, I was just like, you would have been the CEO of like some massive company if given the chance. And it is so heartbreaking to think of all the lost opportunity. Like, it kills me.
Yeah, like, it's thankfully, it's changing now. We're not quite there, but we do see a lot more women in these, you know, higher positions where they can show their own self-worth. But I still think there's a lot of work to go. You know, women who are outspoken and assertive and all the rest can sometimes be seen as bossy and
troublemaker. You know, that's exactly a word that I heard in my career.
You know, it's just, I don't know, it's, attitudes are changing, but there are still a few people stuck in the dark ages in that regard. You know, I think of my wife in particular. She works in a male-dominated career of urban planning,
right?
Which I find boring, but she loves. but you know, she works in a company, and her boss is this, you know, amazing female who is such a leader, and so is Circa, and they're doing great things. Despite, you know, being surrounded by men who wouldn't be as good as them, I think, in their jobs, you know, and but get these opportunities. So it's incredible. She's definitely a role model for me in what she does in her career.
That's great.
You know, and there's many other women out there who are doing it too.
And what about sport? Because it feels like there's been a shift in my lifetime anyway, in terms of men and women in sport. But I feel like you would say that there's still a lot more work to do there.
I know. Look, there's definitely been huge improvements. It's absolutely massive. Even just media coverage has been huge, particularly for soccer and Gaelic football over the last number of years. Rugby as well, in particular, obviously. There's still probably an attitude around the women's game in most codes is not as skillful as the men's, and you know, that's something that frustrates me, because particularly in our squads right across the three codes, we have some of the most talented players around the world, like, and particularly in rugby we have some really, really world-class players, and yet they don't really get the recognition that they deserve compared to their male counterparts. We are getting there, definitely. You know, just this weekend the Irish women's rugby team had a new record, which is brilliant. But there's still a lot of ways to go. That comes from the organisations themselves. It comes from the media and how they portray it. But it also comes from people and attitudes, and go, like, put your bias aside and put that attitude of women's sport isn't as good aside. Go watch a match. And then if you still think that, fair enough.
Yeah.
But go get bums on seats and see what's out there. And I think you'll be pleasantly surprised.
I think as well that what people forget when they talk about women's sport is that, I actually had this conversation with my dad yesterday. I don't know what day it is. Sunday. We were watching the women's Arsenal team. And my dad said, would I be right in thinking that in the WSL, that's the kind of female equivalent of the Premiership, for anyone who's listening and hasn't found their way into this kind of sports fandom as I have over the last couple of years, that he was saying, would I be right in thinking that there's kind of three or four big teams and then the rest of them are kind of, you know, not as good? And I was like, yeah, that's definitely the case. I said, but I think, you know, you have to remember that these are women who came from a sexist infrastructure, who didn't have the same opportunities and investment as girls like yourself, you know, who didn't have a girls team, who didn't have, you know, people taking them seriously from infancy. You know, it wasn't viewed as a career or a potential, you know, commercial, you know, endeavor. Whereas now, finally, for the first time, we're seeing that in women's soccer, not only is it, you know, commercial success, like, you know, you've got Arsenal selling at the Emirates on a regular basis now, that, you know, women can have big, long careers. They can make massive amounts of money from endorsements. Like, they have every opportunity to do the same as men. So now, hopefully, the infrastructure will be put in place that girls will be supported. And therefore, you will have a league full of absolutely incredible players. But we're, you know, 100 years behind men.
And I think it's interesting, because if you were to go back just over 100 years ago now, women's football in the UK was the highest attended sport in the UK, and then they banned it. So, like, you know, if people actually see what's on show, they will like it, as we've seen in the past. But as you said, that it was banned and then they've had to start again. And the women's rugby team are the same. They've only gone professional there in the last 2 years, you know, whereas the men have been professional since the 90s. And I think it's particularly for the rugby team, their comparison is hard because the men are going so well at the minute. Mm. But they've been professional since the 90s. And if you were actually to look at any Irish games in the 90s from that start of that professional era and just before, they were rubbish. Yeah. Like, they were awful to watch. It takes time. And these things don't happen overnight. So I think we just need people to keep plugging away, keep giving them their support.
Mm.
Get down and watch, whether it's a local game or any of the international games in any code. And you will get value for your money.
Yeah, this code, I don't know what that means.
Just like different sports.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. So like,
sorry, I don't speak the language. I'm only learning. Well, Hannah, you said you're playing again. You're playing this year. How are you feeling about that?
Yeah, back with the Dubs, as I said, really difficult decision, having Aoife at home and kind of missing her. We train an awful lot.
She is like so cute, guys. Like so cute. Even as not as her parent, I feel like spending time away from her would be hard.
You're welcome to her anytime. we're really enjoying it. We're a good group of girls. We retained a core group from last year's winning squad, which is brilliant. Nothing is a given in sports, so we're working pretty hard to try and get back to the All-Ireland final this summer, but a bit of work to do in the process, so not looking too far ahead, but really, really enjoying it.
Yeah, well, fingers crossed. I will watch. Do you know, the turning point for me with football was interviewing Katie McCabe. I had kind of completely, I played football for years as a kid. I did not have a great relationship with it, but like I was a referee and everything. Like I was very much in that world. And then I fell completely out and I just had no interest in the men's game. I don't know, there's just too much. There's a kind of a nastiness around the men's game that just doesn't appeal to me personally.
Yeah.
And then I interviewed Katie and I was like, oh, maybe I should pay attention to the women again. And now I'm full, like full in. So maybe you'll be the turning point for me with...
We'll have to get you down to a training session or so.
Well, I, as a spectator...
I'm sure the girls will have you in, teach you a few skills.
I would be on the floor in seconds. Hannah Terrell, thank you so, so much for having me. Thanks for welcoming me into your home and thanks for everything that you've shared. I really appreciate it.
Cheers.
So there you have it. That's it from me this week. Thank you so much to Hannah Terrell for being such an amazing guest and inviting me into her home. And I just am very excited now to hop on the bandwagon. There's no bandwagon I won't join, guys. I feel like you know this by now. I hope you have a lovely, lovely weekend. But obviously, they can't all be good. So don't worry about it if it's not. Just put one foot in front of the other. I will be back with you on Monday with a news update. In the meantime, thank you so much to Acast for having me on the network. And I will talk to you then.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term medical plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term medical plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.